From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning to you. I'm Ira Melman. Coming your way, the umbrella movement in Hong Kong marks its one-month milestone while both sides face an impasse. Afghanistan's leader visits China, his first official trip. India and Vietnam shore up defense and energy ties as China watches. And we'll tell you new ways some American colleges are screening international students. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of Daybreak Asia. It has been exactly 1 month since Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas at large crowds of young pro-democracy activists, sparking the occupation of the Central Business District and outlying commercial areas. As Ivan Broadhead reports from the semi-autonomous Chinese city, protesters and politicians paused Tuesday to reflect back and discuss the way forward.
Tuesday dawned amid a sea of 2,000 tents and countless democracy activists on the streets of the Hong Kong Central Business District. In the cool breeze, a group of students marked the end of the first full month of the democracy protest by singing the lilting refrain of the Umbrella Movement anthem, Under a Vast Sky. The spirit of the activists is typified by 23-year-old Audrey, who says she is heartened that after 30 days of solidarity, of sometimes violent struggle and failed negotiations, the umbrella movement persists, albeit with a degree of soul-searching.
I think it's like a utopia, especially in Admiralty. Like, in Mong Kok, it's more like a war over there. There are fights. Yeah. But here it's very peaceful. So some say it's a revolution of the romantics and the academics. And there are quite a lot of arguments that we should be fighting more, but some say that we shouldn't bleed over this, or else it would be like the Tiananmen incident.
The past few days have presented some signs of disagreement between the three groups leading the movement. Benny Tai, co-founder of Occupy Hong Kong with Peace and Love, insists the movement could engineer a citywide referendum to challenge a Beijing ruling that candidates for Hong Kong's 2017 election be vetted by a pro-China nominating committee. Sharing this view is Hong Kong Federation of Students head Alex Chow, but another influential federation leader, Yvonne Leung, is not persuaded. She believes there are other priorities.
We need to think how to further pressurize the Hong Kong government, or is Hong Kong government the right target for us to continue to ask for something? Because it is quite clear that in short term, actually, the Hong Kong government will not offer anything else.
Divergent opinion reflects the robust health of the movement, insists the chairman of the Pan-Democrat Civic Party, Audrey Yu.
Well, in fact, that is the essence of democracy, that everybody has his or her own view, and it's very difficult to reach a general consensus. But I think the whole umbrella movement has actually brought Hong Kong people together in a way that hasn't been the situation for a very long time. And I think the goodwill is there.
Hong Kong University Public Administration Professor Joseph Chan helped prepare the students for negotiations with the government last week. While opinion polls indicate more Hong Kongers back the students than ever before, Chan reflects the view of a broad section of society that feels they have conducted an exemplary civil disobedience campaign, but should resume talks with the government and find other ways to continue their protest or risk losing public support.
There is such a danger. People are now beginning to say that, hey, wait a minute, we have been tolerating you for so long, we have been supporting you, but so far it seems that the movement is going nowhere, and seems that, you know, there is no further dialogue between the government and the students. It also doesn't seem to be clear that students are getting what they wanted. And so the public might raise questions about, what are you going to do now? Yes, we are willing to support, but for what purposes?
Late Tuesday, the students continue to strategize and sing at the now nightly rally in Umbrella Square. As the strains of Under a Vast Sky fade, its lyrics, sung by thousands, resonate into the second month of the Hong Kong democracy protest. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
China's vice president has expressed hopes for better ties with Japan as he met with a visiting delegation of Japanese governors in Beijing Tuesday. The meeting is the latest sign that leaders in both countries want to improve relations that have been strained by a territorial and historical dispute. The delegation, led by Kyoto Governor Keiji Yamato, is in the Chinese capital to attend the Sino-Japan Governor Forum. The official Xinhua news agency says Vice President Li Yuanqiao told the governors the development of a long-term and stable China-Japan relationship is in line with the fundamental interest of people of the two countries. Li also spoke of the spirit of drawing lessons from history and facing up to the future. China has complained that Japan's conservative government, led by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, is trying to revive the country's pre-World War II militarism. Officials of the United Nations are saying that North Korea has proposed allowing a UN rights investigator to visit the isolated communist country. The proposal was made during a Monday meeting between Pyongyang officials and Marzuki Darusman, the UN special investigator on North Korean human rights. Darusman is set to release a report later this week recommending the Security Council refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court over its rights record. UN officials said the North Koreans Monday urged Darusman to drop the language about an ICC referral, but did not explicitly link this to a possible visit. The Security Council is expected to vote on the issue late November. China, an ally of North Korea, has hinted that it may block the resolution. From VOA in Washington, this is Asia. The presidents of China and Afghanistan have pledged long-term partnership between their nations during the first state visit by Afghanistan's new leader, Ashraf Ghani. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad that many Afghans are optimistic that increased Chinese diplomatic and economic engagement will help bring peace to their war-shattered country.
President Ghani will have a busy schedule during his four-day visit to Beijing, where he will hold in-depth talks with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping on bilateral and issues of common interests. Mr. Ghani will also lead a delegation of Afghan businessmen at a meeting of Chinese investors in his bid to persuade them to develop the mining industry in his strife-torn country. Afghans believe that China's economic and diplomatic support can help their country overcome economic and security challenges after NATO troops withdraw from the country in December. Janan Musazai, Afghanistan's ambassador to neighboring Pakistan, says China is currently the largest investor in his country and bilateral cooperation has expanded in multiple areas.
Over the past 13 years, we have laid down the foundation of a very close, enduring, long-term relationship with China, and both countries are determined to further develop and strengthen these relations in the years to come, starting with President Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai's state visit to Beijing.
In an interview published Tuesday by China's state-backed Xinhua media organization, Mr. Ghani said he sees Afghanistan as a hub for regional trade and investment, and he expects relations with China will expand. China has largely avoided deepening its involvement in Afghanistan's geopolitical affairs and confined its role to an economic investor in the country's natural and energy resource sectors. It has invested nearly $7.5 billion and intends to enhance the Chinese economic footprint in Afghanistan. In the last 2 years, however, Beijing has actively sought to redefine its relations with Kabul and has appointed a special envoy to Afghanistan to further its objective. Sun Weidong, China's ambassador to neighboring Pakistan, underscores the importance of political stability for peaceful reconstruction of Afghanistan.
China believes that the national reconciliation is an inevitable course for Afghanistan to achieve national stability and prosperity.
China is hosting this year's Heart of Asia Istanbul Conference on October 31st, a gathering of regional countries around Afghanistan that discuss ways to promote Afghan national reconciliation and peaceful reconstruction. President Ghani will also attend the event. Ambassador Musa Zai says the conference will go a long way in promoting regional peace.
The fact that China, a key participant of the process, is hosting this ministerial conference at this historic juncture is testament to the importance and significance of this process to our collective efforts for better relations and closer cooperation in our region.
China is concerned that a security breakdown in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of international forces could fuel Uyghur separatism in its restive Xinjiang border region. The Muslim insurgency, some Chinese officials suspect, have links to Islamist militants hiding in border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Afghan officials also believe China can use its influence with its long-term strategic partner Pakistan to persuade it to help Kabul promote reconciliation with the Taliban. Afghan officials have long believed the Taliban directs its insurgency in Afghanistan from safe havens in Pakistan. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
India and Vietnam have shored up ties in the defense and energy sectors during a two-day visit by the Vietnamese prime minister to India. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the deepening friendship between these two countries is being very closely watched by China.
After holding talks with his Vietnamese counterpart in New Delhi, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced his government will quickly operationalize a $100 million line of credit to enable Vietnam to acquire naval patrol vessels from India. This will mark the first significant supply of military equipment by India to the East Asian country. Vietnam is involved in territorial disputes with China in the South China Sea and wants to strengthen its coastal defenses. Vietnamese Prime Minister Nguyen Thanh Dung called defense cooperation an important pillar of the Vietnam-India strategic partnership. Both countries called for peaceful resolution of disputes in the region and stressed the importance of maritime security. The Vietnamese Prime Minister said, as a major power in the region, India should actively support parties involved in the South China Sea disputes.
Both sides agreed on the importance of maintaining peace, stability, maritime security and safety, resolving disputes in the East Sea by peaceful means on the basis of international law.
India's growing ties with Vietnam will likely be closely monitored by China, which has been irked by India's exploration for gas off Vietnam in the South China Sea. It has even called Indian activities in the area illegal, but New Delhi appears unfazed. On Tuesday, the two countries signed an agreement giving India access to additional oil and gas exploration in the South China Sea. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said the two countries will continue to deepen cooperation in this sector and associated industries. In Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei reiterated a warning. Hong said Beijing did not oppose reasonable and justifiable exploration in the South China Sea, but if those activities harm China's sovereignty and national interest, it will firmly oppose. He also urged India not to get involved in the South China Sea dispute. India's efforts to deepen ties with countries like Vietnam in the Asia-Pacific region is seen as an effort by New Delhi to counter China, which has been steadily expanding its influence in countries in India's neighbourhood. Prime Minister Modi said Tuesday that New Delhi is deepening its engagement in East Asia as it considers this region crucial for its future. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
South Korea's spy agency says it has solved the mystery of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's six-week public absence, which set off a frenzy of wild speculation around the world. According to the Associated Press, the National Intelligence Service told legislators that a foreign doctor operated on Kim in September or October to remove a cyst from his right ankle. That according to Park Byung-suk, an aide for opposition leader Shin Kyung-min. The aide said the spy agency also told lawmakers in a closed-door briefing that the cyst could recur because of Kim's obesity, smoking, and heavy public schedule. A leading activist for Myanmar's ethnic Rohingya minority says there is a significant exodus on a scale possibly unprecedented of Rohingya leaving the country. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok reports there are concerns about the fate of those who departed about 2 weeks ago.
The stateless Rohingya reportedly began boarding cargo ships on Myanmar's coast 2 weeks ago at the end of the rainy season. The director of the Atakan Project advocacy group, Chris Leva, tells VOA some of them should have arrived by now in Thailand, but there has been no confirmation of that.
We are very worried because so far none of the families of passengers that have left 2 weeks ago have been contacted to at least get some confirmation that whatever son, brother or husband had arrived. That means they are not in any place where they can contact people, and so we're not sure where they are.
Leva estimates 10,500 Rohingya have fled Myanmar, also known as Burma, since the middle of this month, a much larger than usual number in such a short span of time. Leva blames the exodus in part on reported arbitrary arrests taking place in northern Rakhine State, as well as rumors alleging that three people in detention were tortured to death.
Obviously, when community leaders and religious leaders are being tortured to death, that creates more fear.
The Associated Press quotes a Rakhine State spokesman denying any knowledge of arrests or abuse. A spokesman for UNHCR's Regional Coordinator's Office in Bangkok, Vivian Tam, told VOA News on Tuesday that if the numbers of those fleeing this month are accurate, it's a very strong start to the sailing season and would be very worrying. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya live in isolated communities and are among the world's most discriminated against people. Mostly Muslims, they are considered by the government of Myanmar, a predominantly Buddhist country, to be migrants from Bangladesh. Rights groups are concerned over Myanmar's plan to require all Rohingya and Rakhine State to identify themselves as Bengali or face indefinite confinement in detention camps. Known as the Rakhine State Action Plan, it has been widely condemned outside Myanmar. Recent non-governmental reports on the Rohingya in Thailand and Malaysia called for the two countries to heed customary international law to help all refugees. The reports say Thailand has effectively pushed the problem onto Malaysia, the Muslim-led country that is the preferred ultimate destination for most of the Rohingya who have managed to leave Myanmar. An estimated 37,000 Rohingya are in Malaysia, with another 15,000 awaiting UN recognition as refugees. UN agencies say the restriction of the free movement for hundreds of thousands of people in Myanmar's Rakhine State is severely compromising their basic right to food, health, education, and livelihoods. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Earlier this year, a group of 10 of the top liberal arts colleges in the United States banded together to come up with new ways to select students from overseas, notably China, who wanted to attend their institutions. Among the schools that make up what is called the Liberal Arts College Interview Consortium are Swarthmore, Bryn Mawr, and Barnard College. They all agreed on one thing. They liked the idea of students sending them recorded video interviews carried out by one particular company based in Beijing. Initial View is that company. Its founder and chief executive officer is a Chinese-educated American and former attorney. His name, Terry Crawford. He told me that the success of his company stemmed from the actions of one U.S. college.
3 years ago, Georgia Tech approached us, and they said, we have a tremendous number of applicants from China. We want to make good decisions as we are trying to evaluate them, because on the one hand, they would look very good on paper. And you can imagine, to some extent, it's easy to look good on paper. And oftentimes that might not reflect someone's true ability. And yet at the same time, they knew that there might be top students. Maybe they didn't even get the top scores, but still they would be a top student, someone that has intellectual curiosity, someone who is excited about the school that they're applying to, someone who has the social skills that would really make them thrive at a U.S. institution. And it was from Georgia Tech signing on, really, that we took off. So Georgia Tech recommended that applicants in China come and do our interviews. And then the top students, they would see their interview and then realize, hey, I'd actually like to send this to more schools. And it was basically through that process that the top students wanting to send it to multiple schools that we grew very quickly.
Now, tell me about this grouping of liberal arts colleges. Mm-hmm. You were instrumental in putting that together, I was told. Tell me the story of that.
Many liberal arts schools had told us that they appreciated our interviews and that they felt like it was particularly consistent with what they were trying to achieve in their admissions process, being that they wanted to assess the communication skills of the applicants to ensure that they could do well in a small seminar-type classroom setting that's very common at a small liberal arts school. I had a conversation with a few other schools about potentially putting together this group. We had a conference call where we all discussed what it would look like. And I think what happened was all of these schools realized that liberal arts colleges are becoming more popular in China, and that through this group, they could both continue that trend of liberal arts schools being realized, of Chinese individuals realizing that liberal arts schools can provide them with maybe more attention or a better educational experience. Some Chinese students feel that if they were to go to a large university, they would be lost in the crowd and they would maybe only hang out with Chinese students, and they would end up not having the true college experience. And I think that what had happened is that for the Chinese students who went to liberal arts colleges, parents and their classmates would realize that they had a true college experience where they got to know professors, they got to do their own research. Their friends were well beyond the group of Chinese students who might be studying. They had friends from all over the world, and that was something I think that still is really the ideal American education that Chinese students hope to have, and you know, generally international students hope to have when they come to the U.S. So I think that it's just a process. It's an unscripted interview. We don't rate the candidate. There's no test that we do. It really is an opportunity for the student to talk about what they've been doing and what they hope to do in the future. And then we just give that to the admission officers. And the admission officers, they want to make their own decisions.
Give me an example of some of the questions that are asked by the interviewer.
The initial questions are would not surprise anyone. I mean, there are questions about your high school, questions about your academic interests, questions about the future, what you hope to accomplish when you go to the U.S. The big difference, I think, would be in the second tier level of questions. So the student is going to talk about things that they're interested in, and we're very quickly going to follow up on that and to ask them to expound upon the topics that they bring up in the interview, because we want to really understand them and give them a chance to talk about what their passion is or what it is that really motivates them. Before I started doing this, there's this incorrect notion in the West, I think, that all Chinese students are a certain way and that they don't have their own passions and they don't have the things that they're excited about, and they don't have their own academic subjects that they get very excited about. And I think one of the things is that we try to bring that out in the interview when they say that they've had some experience that was particularly meaningful to them, or they've published some research that was particularly special. We want them to spend some time talking about that and to really describe that for us. And so that is what we think really makes these interviews special for students. You know, they never know what these second tier type questions are going to be like. And to be honest, we don't even know. We just have good interviewers, and so they come in and it's an unscripted conversation. And yet it's through that unscripted conversation that the real personality and drive and a special experiences that each student has had is able to come out.
Terry Crawford, the founder and chief executive officer of Beijing-based Initial View. That's going to wrap things up for us today on Daybreak Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy your day. VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on